Imagine fighting for your life against a horde of, like, 9-foot trolls, only to discover that your entire reality, your trauma, your history, your actual existence is just a game being played by teenagers in another dimension.
Right. It's a terrifying concept.
Totally. Welcome to today's deep dive. You've shared this massive stack of character logs with us from the world of Mirari. And today, we're unpacking a fantasy setting that is just undergoing a complete existential crisis.
It really is. I mean, it is an incredibly ambitious narrative.
Yeah, our mission today is to untangle these two parallel storylines you've brought to us. So on one side, we have a manufactured drought creating this magical monopoly in a desert city.
Which is fascinating on its own.
Oh, absolutely. And then on the other side, there's a desperate siege in a snowy tower that literally shatters the very concept of free will. It's wild. What happens when you fight trolls with completely unlabeled magic potions?
Well, we are looking at a text that takes those classic fantasy tropes, you know, wizards, knights, ancient artifacts, and just forces them through the meat grinder of modern socioeconomics.
And metafictional philosophy, right?
Exactly. It asks, what happens when characters realize the actual architecture of their escapism is fundamentally flawed?
Okay, let's unpack this. We're starting with the economics of magic in this desert trade city, Care City.
Right, the desert city.
Yeah, we have a character named Thomas. He's the Lord Explorer.
Mm-hmm.
And he arrives there with his allies, Rachel and Cirly Felon.
And they meet up with an old friend, wise woman Oberia.
Right, and immediately we are thrust into this massive civic crisis. The city is dying of thirst. So how exactly does a magic system facilitate a drought?
Well, it comes down to the control of a central utility. Oberia explains that Karasiti used to be this thriving oasis.
Okay.
Water flowed continuously from a subterranean source called Gallen Anne, but recently the water just, it simply stopped.
The Great Drought.
Yes, the Great Drought began, and miraculously, a group of black-robed mages appeared in the city shortly after.
How convenient for them.
Right. Very convenient. And they're carrying an ancient artifact, a magical cauldron that once belonged to a legendary figure, Sorcerer King Pelus.
Wow.
And they use this cauldron to summon water, which they then sell back to the desperate citizens.
I read that and immediately thought about modern corporate monopolies.
Oh, it's exactly like that.
I mean, it's not just that they bought the local utility company.
Mm.
It's like they hacked the city's plumbing software, turned off the tap at the source, and are now charging a premium subscription fee for rain.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah. First, they undercut the outside merchants until those guys went bankrupt. And then, with the competition totally eliminated, they skyrocket the prices.
The mechanism of their monopoly relies entirely on artificial scarcity. Magic in Mirari isn't just used for, you know, casting fireballs in combat.
Right, it's financial.
Exactly. It's being weaponized as a tool for economic subjugation. But Thomas, being this intensely analytical leader, he doesn't just accept the narrative that the natural spring dried up.
No, he suspects causality where others just see coincidences.
Right. So he decides to investigate Gallen Anne using a brilliant, totally non-magical wilderness trick.
The feather trick.
Yes, the feather trick. He plans to plant a long griffin or peacock feather deep into the dry dirt overnight.
Now, if you're listening to this and wondering why a feather would help you find water, it's actually grounded in real-world survival mechanics, right?
It is. It operates on the principles of thermal conductivity and condensation.
Okay, break that down for us.
Well, a long feather planted deep in the earth bridges the temperature gap between the cooler subterranean soil and the warmer night air.
Got it.
So if there's still water trapped underground, meaning the spring hasn't dried up, but was deliberately blocked by these mages, moisture will condense into visible beads on the exposed part of the feather by morning.
That is so smart. Thomas is basically using hard physical science to dismantle a magical con job.
Precisely.
And the water monopoly isn't even the only conspiracy they uncover in that little adobe house. Oberia drops some heavy dark lore on them.
She really does.
Thomas has to confess that an old friend of theirs, Randall, had been turned into a wraith. And he's now bound in servitude to an entity known as the Destroyer.
Which is a terrifying concept in this world.
Yeah, I mean, the Destroyer sounds like a pretty absolute title. Who or what exactly is that in the hierarchy of Mirari?
In the context of this setting, the Destroyer represents a cosmic-level entropic threat. It isn't just a political adversary. It's a force that corrupts the fundamental soul of a person.
Like twisting an ally like Randall into a wraith.
Exactly. It establishes that while the characters are dealing with mundane issues like water prices, there is a metaphysical rot spreading through the world.
And that rot seems to be infecting the political structures, too. Oberia mentions a mysterious prisoner passing through Karasidi.
The blonde man.
Right, a handsome blonde, blue-eyed man who looked remarkably like a noble of House April. And he's being transported in bindings by strangers.
And one of those strangers might have been a centaur wearing a magical disguise.
Which is such a wild detail. But Thomas immediately connects this kidnapping to a supposedly accidental death back in May.
He links it to Prince Richard's jousting fatality.
Oh, yeah. The lance.
Yes. The prince was killed when an opponent's lance pierced his armor. But in this setting, tournament lances are specifically enchanted or designed to shatter on impact to prevent lethal trauma.
Right. So the fact that the lance held firm and pierced the armor implies targeted sabotage.
Exactly. Thomas is looking at a massive board of seemingly isolated events, a drought, a kidnapping, an assassination, and realizing someone is systematically thinning out the royal bloodline.
They're hoarding resources. So Thomas is relying on logic, economics, and deduction to solve these systemic issues.
He is.
But across the world, his allies do not have the luxury of intellectual investigation. They are dealing with the raw, chaotic, physical side of Murari's magic in real time.
Yes. We shift focus to the ruined, snowy village of Kyr Beniac.
From the macro-level political thriller straight into micro-level visceral survival.
It's a huge tonal shift. Agatha, who operates under the title Night Redmane, and her companion Hannah are ambushed in the freezing snow.
By trolls.
Horde of trolls. Ropey-limbed, 9-foot-tall, gray-green trolls.
The combat you shared in these logs is incredibly brutal.
Yeah.
It isn't some clean, choreographed sword fight.
No, not at all.
Agatha and Hannah are mounted on war horses, Ahern and Fiona, and they are literally trampling the monsters into the snow.
Yeah.
And when their lances pierce the trolls, the flesh actually sizzles and smokes.
That sizzling is a fascinating application of classic folklore within Murari's combat mechanics.
How so?
Well, trolls, being creatures of wild primal magic, have a severe biological allergy to cold iron.
Oh, like fairies in traditional myths.
Exactly. The introduction of refined metal into their bloodstream causes a violent chemical reaction. It grounds the fantasy combat in a kind of biological realism.
Right. So they've managed to fight their way into this structurally bizarre tower to escape the horde. It's full of crooked stairs and, like, non-Euclidean angles.
It's a very strange building.
Very. They barricade the heavy oak door, but not before a troll tries to force its hand inside. Agatha literally has to press her iron sword blade flat against the troll's fingers, burning it until it finally lets go.
And once they secure that door, the tone of the narrative whipsaws from horror to high fantasy and then straight into absurdity.
Oh my gosh, yes. They climb to the upper floor and discover an ancient shrine that once housed the Holy Grail.
Which is a crucial piece of world history here. The logs note the Grail was the specific artifact used to break the Dark Witch's curse on the land.
Right, but the shrine doesn't hold the Grail anymore. What they find under it is Bregwaine.
I love Bregwaine.
She is a cross-eyed Siamese cat wearing a silvery fish pendant. And when Agatha tries to pick her up, the cat speaks.
Yes.
She literally says, "My name isn't Kitty, it's Bregwaine."
Bregwaine is the magical familiar to Sorcerer Apelles, the same ancient wizard whose cauldron the black-robed mages are currently exploiting in the desert.
That's such a crazy connection.
It is. And Bregwaine is wonderfully haughty. I mean, she is significantly more annoyed that Agatha is messing up her fur than she is about the horde of flesh-eating monsters currently trying to dismantle the tower below them.
She's so unimpressed. And she casually pulls a piece of paper from a box on the shrine. It's a hastily scrawled poetic note from Thomas.
Right. He essentially writes that the enemy is listening, so he can't say exactly where he's going.
But he says he's making his journey short and avoiding pitfalls.
And Agatha decodes the cipher instantly. She realizes journey short points to the Bridge of Sorrows, and pitfalls means the point of peril.
It demonstrates this deep unspoken synergy between Agatha and Thomas. They don't even need plain text to communicate complex tactical movements.
No, they know each other too well.
But I do have to question Thomas's leadership style here. I mean, he leaves his heavily armored allies behind to fight a troll siege, strikes out on his own to investigate a desert, and his primary method of leaving emergency tactical intelligence is handing a cryptic note to a snooty, cross-eyed talking cat.
It's certainly a choice.
I find his lone wolf tendencies incredibly frustrating.
Highly
entertaining, but frustrating.
It is a deliberate character flaw. Thomas carries an immense burden of responsibility, which manifests as a refusal to delegate danger.
He takes it all on himself.
Exactly. But structurally, Bragwaine serves a vital purpose for the world building.
Oh, how so?
Well, introducing a cartoonishly arrogant cat in the middle of a brutal life-or-death siege tells the reader that Mirari is a world fundamentally steeped in contradiction. It does not take itself entirely seriously.
And that contradiction is about to literally break the characters' minds.
Mm-hmm.
Because the tower holds something far more dangerous than the trolls outside.
The mirror?
Yes. Agatha leaves Hannah to guard the stairs and explores this cobwebbed study in the upper horn of the tower.
Yeah.
And she finds a tall, self-standing magic mirror with a gilt frame.
This is where the narrative shifts from a fantasy adventure into a profound existential mystery.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah, because when Agatha accidentally pivots the mirror, it doesn't just show another location in Mirari. It pierces the veil between realities, looking into what the logs call the mortal world, a place named Anakton.
Agatha looks through the glass and sees a modern street scene.
Mm-hmm.
There's a car, a bird mid-flight, but they are completely frozen.
Right, because the time dilation is extreme. Time in the mortal world of Anakin moves exponentially faster than in Mirari.
Okay.
So a fraction of a second there equates to hours or days in the fantasy realm.
And Agatha manages to swivel the mirror's view into the bedroom of a human boy named Simon.
Yes.
She zooms the mirror's focus onto a wire wastebasket filled with crumpled notebook papers. And reading those discarded drafts, she uncovers a complete bombshell confession.
The letters are drafted to Thomas, and they reveal that the Simon they know in Mirari, the noble Sir Lefelon, who is currently helping Thomas investigate the drought in the desert, does not actually exist.
My jaw dropped when I read that.
It's huge. The character of Lefelon is a fabrication, a role being played by a shapeshifting kobold spy named Tatterdemalion, who is secretly working for the traitorous Lord April.
It makes you reevaluate literally everything you've read so far. Nobody in this world is who they seem.
No one.
I mean, the logs mention another character, Alice, who is secretly the presumed dead Princess Angel, hiding her identity for survival. But the Simon revelation hits harder because of the sheer betrayal.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the crumpled drafts show immense psychological torment.
Yeah, he feels terrible.
He really does. Tatterdemalion is a spy, but his discarded letters are full of agonizing guilt. He writes about how kindly Thomas treated him and how terrified he is of the anger Thomas will feel when the truth comes out.
Oh, man.
Tatterdemalion is a spy who fell in love with his fake life, and now the architecture of his lie is just collapsing around him.
And in the mirror drops an even heavier truth about Agatha herself.
Yes, the bandit queen.
Right. In an earlier conversation, Agatha admits that her past in the mortal realm involved playing a game where she took on the persona of the bandit queen. And the actions taken by the players in that mortal game are directly writing the actual history, wars, and reality of Mirari.
It forces us to confront the terrifying concept of determinism within this universe.
It's like playing Dungeons & Dragons, but suddenly your characters become self-aware and realize all their trauma is just the result of someone rolling dice in a suburban basement.
Exactly. If the history of Mirari is authored by teenagers playing a game in a bedroom, does Agatha actually possess free will?
Right.
Every trauma she has endured, every victory she has won, was it her own choice? Or just the downstream result of a teenager rolling a die?
If you're listening and wondering how you'd react, I mean, imagine discovering your entire life's script was written by someone else.
It's paralyzing.
Agatha is struggling with this massive identity crisis. She has inherited this legendary persona of Knight Redmayne, but she actively refuses to let that archetype overwrite her true soul.
Which is her saving grace. She is playing the role assigned to her, but trying to keep her own humanity intact.
It is the ultimate terrifying question of agency. When you realize the system is rigged from another dimension, do you follow your programming or do you try to break the narrative?
Well, the existential dread is compelling, but Agatha has a very pressing physical problem to deal with first.
Oh, right, the trolls.
Yes, the trolls are actively splintering the front door of the tower. Philosophy has to wait. It is time to test out some ancient, completely unlabeled magic.
I love this part. Agatha returns to the stairwell with the chest of ancient potions she found in Pella's study.
The vials survived the freezing temperatures, but they have no identifying marks at all.
None. There is a glowing green one, a white one, and a couple of the pink ones. And Bragwaine the cat is entirely unhelpful.
Completely useless.
She basically just notes that they smell like magic and flat out refuses to drink them.
Which is fair. So with no idea what these liquids do, Agatha and Hannah decide on a strategy of tactical gravity.
Right, they're just going to drop the potions out the high window onto the trolls battering the door below.
It is literal potion roulette.
Potion roulette. How does this kind of chaotic magic even function mechanically?
It functions on the rules of absurdity, which actually perfectly aligns with the revelation of the metagame.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, this isn't a hard scientific magic system where specific ingredients yield predictable elemental results. The magic in Mirari is the manifestation of a game player's imagination.
So they start with the glowing green potion. Agatha drops it. It hits the rocks and creates a massive, blinding flash of light like a magical flashbang.
Yes. Agatha is left seeing spots. But because trolls are subterranean creatures that hate bright light, it stuns them and scatters the front line.
But the door is still failing. The trolls are so desperate, they grab one of their unconscious buddies and start using his head as a battering ram.
Which prompts Hannah to grab the white potion, yeah. And she drops it perfectly.
She does.
It arcs through the freezing air and shatters directly on the head of the unconscious troll being used as a human ram.
And it hears him.
Instantly. The deep hoof print on his head from where a warhorse trampled him completely vanishes.
That's hilarious.
He wakes up perfectly healthy, realizes his friends are using his face to break down a heavy oak door, and he just goes berserk.
Yeah, he starts furiously punching the other trolls. It is pure chaotic slapstick.
It really is.
Next, they try a bright pink potion. It shatters and releases a giant cloud of pink smoke that looks like cotton candy.
And as the smoke clears, the snow is suddenly covered in fluffy pink bunnies and cute little pink chicks.
Which the trolls, being ravenous monsters, immediately scoop up and swallow whole.
Yes, they do.
And this is where the localized reality of the magic violently fails. The pink cloud shifts color to an angry red. The trolls clutch their stomachs, and the logs describe a rapid staccato of fatal explosions.
Horrifying, but effective.
The bunnies were essentially adorable, fluffy time bombs. Why on earth would a potion do that?
Well, because introducing an enchantment designed to create cute, fluffy animals into the brutal, highly acidic digestive tract of a dark magic creature causes an explosive magical reaction.
Wow.
It's the collision of a whimsical spell with a gritty reality.
But they still need one final push to break the siege. They grab the last potion, a hot pink one. Hannah drops the vial, but the stopper comes loose midair. The liquid spills out, forms a dense mist, and solidifies into a giant winged pink elephant.
It's amazing. The immense weight of this instantly materialized creature crashes down, squashing the remaining trolls flat.
Just flattens them.
Yep. The elephant then trumpets angrily, takes to the sky on its massive pink wings, and vanishes in a puff of sparkly powder.
I mean, we have to acknowledge the absolute hilarity of a highly esteemed ancient sorcerer king having a weaponized pink elephant just sitting in his armory.
You know, absolutely.
Kell has clearly understood the assignment.
He did, and it underscores the central theme of this entire narrative.
How so?
Magic in Mirari has a dual nature. It is awe-inspiring and world-altering, capable of breaking ancient curses or drying up entire cities.
Right.
But it is also completely cartoonishly chaotic. It proves that whether you are dealing with a magic potion, a political system, or your own pre-written destiny, you can never fully control the tools you are given.
The world will always introduce an element of the unpredictable.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings us to the core of what we've synthesized today. I mean, we went from analyzing corrupt water monopolies and political assassinations in a desert to dissecting brutal troll combat, mind-bending alternate realities, and explosive pink bunnies.
And the connective tissue between all of these bizarre events is the struggle for agency.
Right.
Just like the citizens of Karasiti trying to survive under an artificial monopoly dictated by mages, or Agatha realizing she is just a piece on someone else's cosmic game board. We all have to navigate systems we didn't build and don't fully understand.
Yeah, that's so true.
But, like Agatha refusing to simply become the Night Red main archetype, we can choose how we play the hand we are dealt.
So what does this all mean for you? I want to leave you with a final lingering thought to mull over.
Let's hear it.
If you walked up to a mirror in your own home tonight and looking through the glass revealed that your entire life, your wins, your losses, your heartbreaks, your career, was just a downstream effect of someone else playing a game in a higher dimension, what would you do?
It's a heavy question.
Would you keep playing your assigned role because the illusion is comfortable? Or would you try to break the rules, shatter the mirror, and write your own script, no matter how chaotic the consequences might be?
Thank you so much for taking this deep dive with us today. Keep questioning the narrative, and we'll catch you next time.